Hi, this is Jim Swilly. Welcome to Metron Live. Metron is a Greek word that means sphere of influence. I believe in living your best life possible, and that's the reason for this podcast. This is my Metron. Now let me help you discover yours. I encourage people to bring lunches today. Did you bring enough for everybody? I was going to go buy MetroFresh, but like I said, it takes Ken so long to get his hair done in the morning, it made us run late. So I said, we're going to have to just go on. I said, he was crying, and I was like, baby, you're pretty. Let's go. You have no idea what I have to live with. So anyway, we didn't pick up anything, but I wondered if, would Grubhub deliver to the park? I've got Grubhub. Oh, there's BJ and Joe. Okay, good. Cool. Hey, Romanita. Hey, Rhonda. interestingly enough, when I got up yesterday, I thought, what am I going to, because I'm not in a series right now, and I thought, what am I going to talk about tomorrow? And when we're in the theater, I always try to get an outline to Michelle as soon as possible, because I know she puts a lot of time and effort into it. But since we're not doing that right now, I'm a lot more off the cuff. Y'all came back two in a row. Look at God. There's going to be a revival in the last. BJ, you crack me up. What'd you say? Yes, he will. Anyway, especially in the fall, we like to do a lot of day trips on a Saturday, just someplace close by. And yes, we've been to Chattanooga a bazillion times. We still love it as much as we always did. So we drove up there and parked the car, there where the aquarium is, all that little area there. They've sort of blocked it off. Now they have tables out there so people can eat outside or order takeout. But a lot of people were out there. Most people had masks on. People were being pretty good about it. When we got out of the car, Ken said, somebody's preaching. And there was a guy a couple blocks away who was on a bullhorn preaching. And the sound was carrying. You could kind of hear it everywhere. And I was telling him, I said, I used to do that. I used to preach over a bullhorn. I said, just be glad you met this incarnation of me. But it was fine what the guy was saying. I mean, there's a part of me that wants to say, buddy, everybody's just out here having a good time. It's Saturday. Most of these people are probably Southern Baptist. I'm sure they've probably all prayed the sinner's prayer. So why don't you just... I went off for a second, but I guess I'm back on. It says I reconnected. I wonder if I should turn the... Should I turn the Wi-Fi off? I'll just leave it on. I think it's fine. Avery, I think that's why my... I've used up so many minutes, because I'm doing this through the phone. So if you... Yeah. Anyway, I don't understand how all that works. But usually... did I go off for a second, Jeanette? Okay. It's not because it's too hot. It's just the devil. The devil's a lie. Anyway, he was saying you could visit the tombs of great people. And he said something. He said that some people don't have a tomb. He said Adolf Hitler died. And just as we were getting close to him, he said, but he was saying you can't visit the tomb of Jesus because Jesus resurrected. And it's a valid point. I mean, nobody's listening to him. I mean, he's just out there preaching. And but just as we got to him, he was talking about, it says I'm in slow motion. Okay. Let me try to turn this Wi-Fi off. Hang on a second. I'm back. If you think I'm in slow motion, maybe you took NyQuil last night. Maybe that's on you. The devil hates Wi-Fi. That's funny. Anyway, just as we, I mean, I was sort of in one ear and out the other listening to him. We were walking over to the Walnut Street Bridge that we love. And but just as we got sort of in front of him, he said, but who did Jesus say he was? He said, before Abraham was, and I answered him back. He said, I am. And when he said that, I mean, he just kept talking. He didn't even notice me, but there was such an energy on that word. It's John 8:58. Before Abraham was, I am, that I just felt it vibrate all through me. And by the time we got to the bridge, I told Ken, I said, I just got my word for tomorrow. And, yeah, you're right, Dr. A. That's the advantage. If y'all were here in person, it wouldn't be broken. You got to come up here where I am, is what you got to do. Get my bullhorn. Go get my bullhorn out of the trunk. Anyway, so sort of the rest of the day while we were sightseeing a little bit, drove up on Lookout Mountain, I kept sort of thinking about that scripture, and a couple of times I would go, great thing about having access on your phone is you don't have to carry Bibles around with you, and like any translation you can think of is online. So I was going back and reading John chapter 8, because I thought there's something there. There's something. I think we drove up to Chattanooga today for me to hear that street preacher say, before Abraham was, I am, because it just really deeply resonated with me. And what's interesting about that verse, when you see it in context, well, let me pan the camera back even further. The full story of John chapter 8 is where Jesus is in the temple, and it's where the Pharisees bring the woman caught in adultery to him. And it's when they say, Moses' law says she should be stoned. What do you say? And Jesus, he writes on the ground, and biblical scholars have debated for years about what he was writing. I have my own feelings about it, but at a certain point during his writing, the men who brought this woman one by one sort of gave it up and just left. And they all left to the point that finally Jesus looked at the woman and he said, well, where are your accusers? And she says, well, I don't have any. And he says, well, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Meaning, this is a very patriarchal world for religious people who don't understand that adultery involves two. So they apparently high-fived the guy you were with but brought you out here. So this was not a message against adultery. And just bear with me here for a minute, because I'm going to say some things I've never said before. But his point was, the condemnation isn't coming from God. It's coming from these accusers. Because when she says, I don't have any accusers, he didn't say, well, it doesn't matter. God still don't believe in adultery. So with or without the accusers, God's still mad at you. That's not what he says. He basically says, well, if nobody here on the lateral plane is accusing you, then you're good to go. I mean, you have to really read between the lines to understand what he is saying there. Because he's basically saying condemnation doesn't come from God. Now, the title of my sermon is not Adultery is Okay. That's not my point. But I am going to think outside the box here for a little bit. Now, when you read the rest of the chapter, apparently there was still an audience there, because the continuation of the conversation is still between him and some Pharisees. You know, typically when this is taught, or when you see this depicted in biblical movies, it usually just ends up with just Jesus and the woman. But apparently, if you read the whole chapter in context, apparently the only ones that left were the ones that brought her there with the agenda. I don't even know if they were going to actually stone her. Historians say that stoning nearly was like an urban legend. It didn't really happen that much. It was kind of those things like threatening your kid that you're going to get a belt when you have no intention of ever doing it, but it just, you know, it's the fear that you play on. And because the conversation that ensues after this thing, where he says, go and don't get yourself in this kind of trouble again, it's playing off of this thing. I don't know if they, I don't think they were wanting to stone her as much as they were wanting to expose him for being a fraud. I don't know. Maybe they were trying to stone her. Because at the end of the chapter, it says they actually, the ones that were still there picked up stones to throw at Jesus. But again, this might have just been a thing that people talked about and never really did. There's a lot of things that people say that happens that I don't know if it really happens. But stoning was definitely part of Moses' law, that is for sure. And that's what they were basing their accusation on. And sure enough, you know, it was, you shall not commit adultery was in Moses' original 10 that was there on Mount Sinai. But in the conversation that ensues, they start talking about Abraham. And Jesus gets really in their face about it, because he's saying, he basically says, if you were really of your father Abraham, you would recognize who I am. And they go back and forth, and there's a lot of, you know, they're at loggerheads with one another. But then in what we have as verse 56, 57, and 58, it's some very next level stuff. Because in verse 56, Jesus says, Abraham lived and was able to see my day, and it made him glad. In other words, he said, even though Abraham lived centuries ago, he saw me and he was glad that I'm here. So in verse 57, they said, well, how could you know so much about Abraham? You're not even 50 years old yet. You know, Jesus was 33 when he was crucified. And then in verse 58 is when he says, this is really where the power is. He says, before Abraham was, I am. That's what I want to talk about today. And I've taught on this a lot. I've taught on the I am out of Exodus and out of John, but I want to hold the diamond up to the light and turn it a little bit and show you another facet of this revelation. I don't believe in reincarnation in the Hindu sense. But clearly, when you read the Gospels, the Jesus' peers in his time did not think of people from other eras being really removed from them. Like, remember on the Mount of Transfiguration, Moses and Elijah appeared, and the disciples not only were all that freaked out about it, they seemed to know who they were. They said, well, we should build tabernacles, you know. I mean, if I was standing here and on my right, suddenly it was, you know, Malcolm X and Martin Luther King materialize, wouldn't you notice that? Even if you recognized them, wouldn't you be like, wow, Bishop, that was kind of amazing when you were bringing up people who had died some time ago. And especially when it was Moses and Elijah who had been dead for centuries. And then on another occasion, Jesus says, he's talking about John the Baptist, and he says, some of you aren't able to bear what I'm about to say. He said, but John the Baptist is Elijah. Now, some people would say, well, he just meant he came in the spirit of Elijah. Well, okay, but Jesus said he was Elijah. That's all I'm saying. And you know, if I really wanted to push the envelope, Elijah didn't die. I mean, he left in a fiery chariot. So, I mean, I could make the case that he existed in another dimension. Of course, I think kind of everybody still exists in another dimension, but I'll get to that in a moment. And even over there in Matthew 16, when Jesus says to his disciples, he says, well, who do men say that I am? They said, well, some say you're Moses or one of the prophets. Some say you're John the Baptist. And Jesus wasn't taken aback by it. He wasn't like, what? How dare they say that? You know, we're not Hindus. He said, well, who do you say that I am? And that's when Peter said, I say you're the Christ. And even when, remember when Herod's stepdaughter asked for the head of John the Baptist? Herod didn't want to kill John the Baptist because he was afraid he was Jesus reincarnated. I'm not making this up. This is all in the Gospels. This isn't in some Hindu holy writ. This is in your Judeo-Christian Bible. And so what I want to talk about, it's interesting, and I'll get back to the adultery piece in a minute. But when he says, before Abraham was, I am, he's talking about two complete different realities. He doesn't say, before Abraham was, I was. He's not saying, I existed here before, I existed on this earthly plane before Abraham was born. He didn't use the word was talking about him. He used the word am. Even the writer of Hebrews, when he talks about the high priest Melchizedek, he says there was no record of his birth or his death. He just sort of was. But the part that I want to bring up to you today is, and this is what really grabbed my spirit yesterday, when I got up close to that preacher and bullhorn was about that far away from me, so I heard it loud and clear. I was like, I get it, universe. It's a word for me. Got it. He said, Jesus said, before Abraham was? And I said, I am. And I just felt, it was like a tsunami went through me. I thought, wow, there's something about just saying the I am. It's very powerful. You know, there in John chapter 18, when Jesus was arrested, the Roman soldiers said, where is Jesus of Nazareth? King James said, he said, I am he. But if you look in the Greek, he actually said, I am. And when he said, I am, just the power of it made them all fall backwards to the ground. And so for years, I've talked about, you know, the power of the I am. You know, when Moses in Exodus 3 hears the voice tell him to let my people go, he said, well, the Egyptians have a lot of gods. Who shall I say sent me? And he said, you tell them the I am sent you. And there's just a power on that. That's why affirmations that you make using the word I am are very, whatever word you fill in the blank with after I am, I don't know how to explain this to you, and I can't prove it scientifically, but something changes in your makeup when you say I am. When you say I am, whatever you say after, it's nearly like, dare I say the word incantation? It's nearly like that. Like we were watching Beetlejuice the other night, and the thing was, if they said the name Beetlejuice three times, the apparition would appear. The phrase I am is nearly that powerful. It's like if you say I am, whatever you say after that, you become. But where I want to take it this morning is, he says, before Abraham was, I am. This is what really became clear to me. We were standing there on the Walnut Street Bridge, and I was videoing there. I love the Tennessee River there. It was very calm. And I, you know, in Genesis it said, Moses said that the Spirit hovered over the face of the deep. He says that in the creation narrative. He says the Spirit was hovering over the face of the deep. And I think that's why we feel so attracted to water. I know we're largely made up of water, so we feel a connection to it. But there's great revelation hovering above the bodies of water. Do you understand what I'm saying? By the way, I'm going to speak I'm way up here today. I'm on the mount. Jesus climbed up on the mountain. He says, come up where I am. So, and those of you who are here today, I know you either smoked enough weed back in the day or you're something that you're like, yeah, we're good with it. Take us higher. You know who you are. And some of you watching today, maybe smoking even as I speak. I'm not validating it. I'm just saying it. Don't shoot the prophet. I'm just saying, you know who you are. I didn't say it was a, I just smelled it. Did you smell it? I just got a whiff of it. That's so funny. I just spoke that. I swear. I just, yeah. Bring it up for the class. I'm joking. But there was, we were standing there. I even put a little video of it on Instagram, and I thought, wow, why is it? I just love to sit here and look at water. A couple of weeks ago, we were in Panama City, and I just wanted to sit on that deck and look at the water. And I think it's because there's a way you hear the voice of God speak on water. I don't know why, but Moses noticed it. He said the Spirit was hovering over the face of the deep. So I just heard, before Abraham was, I am. Those are two different realities. Let your spirit hear me now. There's either a was-is reality or there's an am reality. You either live in the I was this or I will be this, or you live in the I am this. So when Jesus said, before Abraham was, what he was saying is there was an incarnation of a man that we called Abraham. Who really, Abraham was really the first monotheist. I mean, when Moses wrote Genesis, he was still writing from the paradigm. You know, Moses was schooled in Egypt where they were, even the name Moses, it's an Egyptian name. It's not a Hebrew name. It's like Moses, like Ramses. It's like a Pharaoh's name. So Moses was raised to believe in many gods. He was a polytheist. That's why when he writes the creation account, he uses the plural pronoun. Let us make man in our image. He doesn't speak of God as being a singular entity. He speaks of God as, well, the word Elohim is God's plural. It just is. So Abraham was the first one to say, well, no, you're talking about different gods, but it's really all the same one. And I think Abraham's monotheism was misinterpreted. And so what happened is, for people that didn't hear what Abraham was really saying, they developed the us versus them religions. You know, we believe in the one true God. When really what Abraham was saying is, they're called by many different names, but they're all God. I've shared this with you before, and this may get lost on some people, but years ago, this is, you know how you can look at things that happened on your spiritual journey that were really touchstones? Years ago, when I was on the College of Bishops with the ICCC, the International Communion of Charismatic Churches, they usually would do their conference in a different country every year. And one year it was in England, Great Britain, UK. And Dr. T.L. Osborne was speaking one night. We had been flying all day and everybody was jet lagged. He had been preaching for a long time. Nobody was really listening to him. Most of the bishops on the platform were asleep, you know, because he just was talking a long time. If you don't know who T.L. Osborne was, he was a great 20th century apostle of healing. I don't know how much of this is you know, spin or whatever, but the stories are that in some of his crusades, especially back during the 40s and the 50s, he would pray for 100 blind people who would all receive their sight at one time, or 20, 30 people in wheelchairs or on stretchers would get up and walk. If all the reporting is true, he had more documented miracles than some of the more well-known people like Catherine Kuhlman or Benny Hinn. I'm not here to argue whether all of that actually happened. I want to believe him. But suffice it to say, if anybody knew about the power of the name of Jesus, it would be T.L. Osborne. I'm talking about old school, there's healing in his name kind of theology. Y'all with me? So he starts kind of talking about world religions. And he says some people call him Allah. Some people call him Siddhartha, which really, in Buddhism, Siddhartha is not a name of God. It's a name of a prophet, but whatever. Tomato, tomato. He starts going through the names. Some people call him Krishna. Some people call him Vishnu. He goes through all these names of God. He says, but his name is Jesus. And, when Debbie and I were married, I turned to her and I said, did you hear what he just said? I couldn't believe people weren't shocked. I mean, I would have been kicked out of Bible school for saying something like that. Because we were taught there's no other name by which men can be saved, and that's a false doctrine or whatever. And here's the man with the name of Jesus pedigree saying, they call him Allah, but his name is Jesus. He's basically saying all roads lead to God is what he's saying. And then years later, when I was introduced to the Kabbalist manuscript, even Jesus called God Allah, which, as it turns out, is a derivative of Elohim. So it's like, wow, you know, all these roads, you know, somehow end up to the one true God. Even some of you know who Dr. Kluwani Spake is. Her son David used to come to church in the now Midtown. She's a apostle of, you know, she's a Christian apostle. But she said that she had been, years ago, she had been disconnected from her brother because he had gone through New Age and, you know, he lived in, like, I don't know if it was Berkeley, but it was someplace like that. New Age capital. And I don't know if that's why they had become disconnected. But anyway, he was, in her mind, he was lost because he was looking for God through drugs, through whatever. And one day she, if I remember this story correctly, she said she's at a red light and she looks over at him and he's sitting at the car next to her and motions her over. And he says, can you baptize me in the Pacific Ocean? And she said, you're a Christian now? And he said, all roads eventually lead back to Jesus. He said, I've gone through everything. He said, I don't renounce it. He said, but it's all led me to the one true God. Even this guy yesterday, I could hear him a couple of blocks off. He was saying, Jesus said, unless a man's born again, he cannot go to heaven. And that's not what Jesus said. He said, unless a man's born again, he will not see God. He will not see the Father. Jesus said in John 14:6, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. He didn't say no man comes to heaven but by me. People have created a whole doctrine. I mean, I could even take it so far as to say the doctrine of the new birth was really what he just said to Nicodemus. I mean, he didn't really say it to everybody else, because to the rich young ruler, he said the way to salvation is to sell everything you have and give it to the poor. We didn't make that a doctrine for everybody. To the woman who washed his feet with her hair, he said, this is the way to salvation. Become a hooker and wash a man's feet with your hair. You know, her sins, which are many, are forgiven because she loved much. We didn't make that a doctrine. He goes to Zacchaeus' house, and Zacchaeus, who had ripped people off for years, says he's going to restore fourfold everything that he's stolen. Jesus stands up and says, this day salvation has come to your house. So the whole idea that everybody has to be born again to go to heaven is not even supported from the New Testament. Jesus didn't even say that. What he was saying to Nicodemus is, because Nicodemus started that thing in John 3. He says, we know that you're from God because nobody could do these miracles unless he was from God. And Jesus says, unless you are born again, you're not going to see God. In other words, you're seeing me through your religious paradigm, and you're going to have to unlearn what you've learned and be born again. Being born again is not going to the altar at a Billy Graham crusade and praying a sinner's prayer. And yes, I've read Romans 9 and 10, Romans 10, 9 and 10, believe in your heart, confess with your mouth. I'm very familiar with that. But the idea of everybody must be born again is not what Jesus preached. He was he gave individual words to people. One guy he healed by taking dirt and spitting on it, making mud. He only did it for that guy. He didn't make a doctrine out of that. The problem with the Christian church is people took individual rhema words that Jesus gave to individuals and made them a doctrine from everybody. And that's why they've been so impotent. And I'm gonna bring back to the adultery piece, talking about that in just a moment. Bear with me. But back to, I've opened several windows here. Are y'all still with me? Up here. So I remember when I heard T.L. Osborne say that, I can remember, I don't know if you can feel a new neuropath open in your brain, but I imagined that idea. I remember a part of my brain opening up like, wow, if I had heard some new age guy said that, if I'd heard Wayne Dyer say that, I would be like, well, yeah, of course that's what you believe. If I'd heard Deepak Chopra say that, yeah, of course you believe that. When I heard T.L. Osborne say that, I thought, wow, I'm really surprised you believe that. And I think it kind of went over everybody's head. Either they were too jet-lagged or they just weren't ready for it yet. And then I've told you, I'm not going to repeat all those stories, but I told you about the Muslim man in Nigeria that I prayed with, and the Japanese man in Korea who I met that crossed himself when he saw my cross. I mean, I can look back at these things that I know were from the Holy Ghost. I know they were. That were preparing me for standing in this park on September 9th or September 20th. See, I don't even know what date it is. Before Abraham was, I am. I'm living outside of dates. I can look at all those things. That's why when I heard Bishop Pearson start to talk about inclusion, I was totally prepared for it. Because I thought, well, that's really kind of, I've been on that trajectory anyway. I remember back in the 80s, just a few blocks from here, Kenneth Copeland preaching at our church out of 2 Timothy 4:10, where he says, he is the Savior of all men, comma, especially them that believe. Even Kenneth Copeland, who now preaches more about Donald Trump than he does about Jesus. Back then, he said, the whole world is saved, they just don't know it yet. And I remember thinking, wow, that's a really different concept. And I went and looked at it. Sure enough, that's what the scriptures actually say. It's amazing how if you can be born again out of your religious indoctrination and read the Bible through the paradigm of Revelation, it's amazing how it'll open up to you. And things, little Easter eggs that were hidden there all along, you think, how did I not see that? That was always there. All right, so back to this thing about before Abraham was, I am. Even when we got here today, Karen was the first one here, and we somehow got talking about death and dying, and we got morbid quickly. I said, good Lord, how did we get on this subject this quickly? And I told her, I said, you know, I've because of growing up in a pastor's home and being around death and dying so much, I don't mean I'm indifferent to it, but I don't see it the way I think people who haven't seen it as much as I have see it. I mean, I'm just aware that, oh, it happens. I mean, people are born and they die. And I mean, I can remember when I was real little, you know, back in when we, especially when Dad pastored in Tennessee, if some matriarch of the church was dying, everybody would go over to the house and kind of hold vigil. I can remember playing out on the porch when Sister So-and-so died and looking through the screen you know, and people were in there singing and praying. And, you know, I don't even think my parents know that I saw that, but I remember watching her pass away, and it wasn't that scary. I mean, you know, 3 years ago, yesterday was the anniversary of my father-in-law passing, and I was standing by Ken watching him when we watched the heart monitor stop, and he stopped breathing. And then 3 or 4 months ago, Ken was standing there with me when my dad passed. I mean, it's a very bonding thing when you've seen you've shared that experience. And even, not to sound callous about it, but when I was growing up, we were putting animals down all the time. I mean, I guess I'm just not as impacted by death as some people. I nearly think it's not real. And I think it's because, I mean, I do know that people pass away and you have to bury them or cremate. I mean, I'm not saying it's not real. I'm saying my mind is so fashioned to live in the I am that I don't really know how to live in the I was or the I will be. Let me see if I can explain it this way. The original setting of this was the woman caught in adultery, okay? So that's what spurred this whole conversation. Like, how did they get from adultery to before Abraham was, I am? Now, I'm not, let's see, how do I put this? I want to be sensitive to what I'm about to say here, because to the pure in heart, all things are pure. I'm not saying adultery doesn't have an impact, because it does. I mean, I've counseled with couples over the years where there was people calling me. Tell Miguel I'm preaching. Hey, what are you doing? I'm preaching. This is my gig. Anyway, what was I saying? I've seen it break up some couples. I've seen some couples survive it. I've counseled with some couples that I've said, look, this doesn't have to destroy your marriage. You can get past it. I know other people who have. Things are probably not going to be the same with you after this point. And you're going to have to be realistic about that. Because now you've violated a trust. And it's always going to be an elephant in the room. And you need to know it just is. Doesn't mean it has to destroy your marriage. And I have said to them, the problem's not with God. It's with the way you guys relate to each other. What's that got to do with, hey, bud, before Abraham was, I am? Well, you can use my chair. I'm not using it. You remember, I'm not going to tell you this whole story again, because, I mean, I've told this one enough. You could definitely number it as one of my stories. But you know, I've told you over and over again how I had the visitation from my grandparents years ago when I was getting so much hate mail and everything. And I don't think it was a dream. I really think the veil was moved back, because what are the plates they call the plates on the bottom of the earth? Tectonic. I felt my tectonic plates shift. Because my grandparents in this vision asked me, what's going on with you? And I said to them, well, I don't know if y'all on that side know, but I came out and this is what's happened and blah, blah, blah. And the grandparent I was the closest to, who was my maternal grandmother, she looked at me and said, she says, Jim Earl, on that side, things like that matter, but on this side, they don't matter. And it was so different for her, because I always remember my grandmother, Addie Mae, the only time she quoted scripture was to talk about what the Bible was against. Anything you mentioned that sounded fun, she would say, Bible speaks out against that. I mean, she was raised that old school. In her mind, the Bible was a rule book that was supposed to keep your butt in line. And even some things she would say, the Bible speaks out against that. I'd say, Grandmother, I don't think that's in the Bible. And she said, well, the Bible speaks against grandchildren sassing their grandmother. You know, she'd make up stuff. And it was such an interesting experience for me, because I remember when I got up off that bed, I felt bulletproof. And pretty much after that, the hate mail and death threats stopped. Because, you know, I've got a theory that once you stop bleeding, you stop attracting sharks. And if there was any idea in my mind that I wasn't okay or I wasn't okay with God, religious people had a way to sort of sniff that out and attack me with my own scriptural knowledge. Once my grandmother told me I was okay, it was just like, bump that noise. I don't care what, you know, I don't care what you say. And the reason I'm bringing that up in the context of was before Abraham was, I am. The laws that came through Moses, which Jesus replaced with just love God, love your neighbor, they were all for lateral relationships. You were never separated from God. Paul said we were alienated from God in our minds. But Paul comes along and says, nothing could separate you from the love of God. Neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principality. Oh, I felt separated. No, you maybe went to an altar and it felt like you became right with God, but it's because you changed your paradigm. What you're calling passing from death into life is really you waking up to who you've always been. I'm not saying it didn't matter for Jesus to die on the cross. I'm saying it was never about God. This whole idea that God can only deal with us through the blood, it first of all is unscriptural, and it's also kind of insulting. It's like, you know, it'd be like saying, ladies, let's say your husband saw you without your makeup on one day, and he said, I cannot be married to you without your makeup. And you're like, he can only see me with false eyelashes. I don't know that my dad ever saw my mom totally without makeup, because she came from that generation that you always want to look your best for your husband. You know, there's women that get up and get made up before their husband wakes up. I've been known to throw in a ball cap before Ken gets up, because I go look in the mirror and I'm like, nah, he didn't need to see that. let's find a ball cap. I'm going to be a little cuter. I don't think he would mind, but I get that concept of, well, I want you to see me the best way you possibly can. But unconditional love is, I always loved you. Even Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane said, if there's any way around this, let this cup pass from me. In other words, it wasn't like he said, I know if I don't go to the cross, all humanity is going to be lost. No, that's not what he said. Basically, he was saying they're never going to believe this about themselves, because they're still, from the first time they had that thought that Moses called a serpent, who said, who told you were naked, mankind has been trying to deal with his own nakedness all this time. And that's why Jesus was naked on the cross. I mean, if you really read how they were crucified, he didn't have a loincloth on. The nakedness was part of the experience. It was not just to torture them, but to shame them. It was to be exposed in your nakedness. Let me show you who this criminal really is. So the fact that Jesus took our nakedness to the cross was his way of saying, you never did need those fig leaves. The fig leaves weren't hiding you from God anyway. Who told you even needed them? I remember, again, a story I've told you a lot, and this is nothing against communion. some of the greatest experiences I've ever had have been in communion. But I clearly remember before I started Metron, I was walking down Spring Street. I was just passing the Varsity, and I'm not saying a light shone out of heaven, but I heard a voice say, clear as a bell, and I was not thinking about communion because I was good at serving communion. That was kind of my jam. But I remember I heard the voice say, you know, people think communion is eating that bread and drinking that wine. That's not what I meant. When I said, this is my body, I was talking about the relationship I had with those men around that table, not the bread. The bread was just symbolic. And it was just a paradigm shift for me. It wasn't like I stood up and said, I will never serve communion again. I don't know. I might do it next week. But I know that's not what Jesus was really talking about. Communion is when you're having this connection with somebody and there's a thing that you're talking about where you just want to freeze it and say, I love this moment. I love this time. I've had it with some of you who are here, where you just have this moment. We didn't need elements. We were having communion, where two or more are on the lateral plane, there is a manifestation of the I am. So what's that got to do with adultery? What I'm saying is our concept of sin is about this. It's about the was and the is. It's not about the am. I'm not saying go commit adultery and you'll be fine. No, it could very easily ruin your relationship, but not because of how God looks at it. I think that's why on the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus was so extreme, because he said, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but I say if you've even hated your brother, you're a murderer. That's a very extreme statement. I mean, if I stood up today and said, I got to tell y'all something. I hate so-and-so. You know, I hate this. I don't want to say any political figures. Let me say, if I say, you know, I hate Tom Cruise. I don't know what about, he just rubs me the wrong way. I just hate him. I hate his movies. I hate what he stands for. I hate the Scientology stuff. Hate him, hate him, hate him. There isn't one of you that would call 911 and say, we've got a murderer loose in the park. Because in our mind, we would say, well, I didn't kill him. I just hate him. Which I don't really hate Tom Cruise, but I'm just, that was the first name that came to my mind. But if I'm going to take Jesus literally, he said, if I hate somebody, I'm a murderer. And I think what he was doing there is just turning that Pharisaical thing inside out. He says, you've heard it said, do not put your wife away except for adultery. I say, if you fantasized about it, you've committed it. Well, that's probably every married person who's ever lived. If we're going to take it literally, and don't say it, not me, because I guarantee you, if you've been married longer than a year, there was somebody somewhere that you saw that you had to make a decision and say, not worth it. I love my spouse enough. They ain't worth it. But you had the thought. And according to what Jesus said, you're divorced. You don't even have to call an attorney. It's already done. And I think Jesus was speaking in hyperbole. He was saying all of this obsession that you have over judging people. Because if you read all of that 8th chapter of John, Jesus even says, I don't judge anybody. It's amazing to me how Christianity has become so judgmental. Because they didn't get it from Jesus. They got it from the serpent. The serpent who said, who told you you were naked? When people say, well, when you get saved, you don't sin anymore. That is not true. I've heard theologians argue about that for years. People say, well, people get married, they don't commit adultery anymore. Yes, they do. People get saved, they don't commit adultery anymore. Yes, they do. I remember talking to a pastor's wife from an old line Pentecostal church who finally divorced her husband because he had slept with so many women in the church. Who, in talking to her, I said, wow, I'm really amazed, as you know, the women in your church aren't even allowed to wear makeup or pants or earrings. I'm surprised. She said, yeah, but everybody in that choir is sleeping with each other. I thought, wow, that's amazing that people are fixated on what you think is sin, but there's all this stuff going on that's not, but just because it doesn't look that way to you, you don't think it's sinful. I remember, I won't say his name, and he's been dead for so many years now, nobody would know who I'm talking about, but old school fire and brimstone preacher. He had a Bible college, big time gay basher, big time all homosexuals are going to hell. I mean, all, real big into end times, rapture. This is the hope that purifies you. Like, that was his thing. People need to get right because Jesus is coming. This is like 50 years ago. Jesus is coming back any minute. And I remember hearing a testimony of this couple that got married out of his Bible college who were supposedly virgins, because everybody in his Bible school was supposed to be virgins. And on their wedding night, the wife says to the husband, she says, I need to tell you something. So I'm not a virgin. I've been sleeping with brother so-and-so for the last 10 years. He says, well, I need to tell you something. So have I. And it was like such a shock because this guy's a big gay basher. And he was bisexual and actively bisexual. So just because somebody's preaching against sin, it don't mean jack. I'm telling you, what people say and do, very different things. What's that got to do with before Abraham was, I am? Well, the system of legalism, of thinking there's a thing that separates you from God, is not an I am consciousness. You know, I was raised on dispensationalism, which was not just about end time stuff. That, you know, our theology was there was a antediluvian stage. That was the stage from creation to the flood. I remember in my Dake Bible, Dake even believed there was a pre-Adamite race. Then there was the antediluvian age. Then there was the age of the major prophets, the age of the minor prophets, the age of innocence. There were all these, they had it broken. There was a whole theology that was based on it. If you ever saw any of those Clarence Larkin drawings, he would draw a lot of, they were using the Dake Bible. I know that these references are lost on a lot of you, but he would draw out these, you know, the different times that we are living in. And again, that's a was, is, I was, or I will be mentality. Jesus says, before Abraham was, before there was this thing that we call time, that a man named Abraham was born into and gave you words that dealt with a certain time, I was already an am. I opted out of was and is. I've always been here. The other night we were listening to, I listened to a lot of 70s radio, and I hadn't heard this song in years, this Barry Manilow song, I Write the Songs. And he's writing it, it's a song, he's writing it as music. The tagline of the song is, I am music and I write the song. He was talking about, I wrote songs to make you dance, whatever. And I thought, wow, that really sounds, that's an I am mentality. What he's saying is, music was always here, and then people came into the time plane and pulled pieces of the I am out into the was and the will be. But I believe that Spirit is calling us out of the I was and the I will be into the I am. The I am, I'm not just obsessed with adultery today, but I'm using this as a point of reference. When you live in the I was versus the I will be, you know, another great 70s song was the Barry Gibb, Barbara Streisand song. It says, you let the stranger in, who's sorry now? The point of the song is, we were doing okay until you messed up and then we were never okay again. That's a was-is consciousness. You understand? And I'm not saying, again, if you think, wow, that was an interesting sermon. It was adultery. It's good. That's not what I'm saying. I'm using it as a metaphor because in John's gospel, that was the context that Jesus was saying before Abraham was, before Moses was, before the Ten Commandments were, before the law was. I am. I existed before the law. I exist after the law. And that's why sometimes when you feel like you were here before, maybe it's because you were here before. When you walk in that I am consciousness, it changes the way you think about time. I mean, honestly, I hate everything about COVID. I mean, I just, it's brought horrible stuff to our world. The upside is it has forced us to think differently about the passage of time. In a weird, I'm not saying God sent it, but in a weird kind of way, it's forced us out of a was and an is into an I am. Like, I think the Emmys are on tonight. And it's interesting. I'm interested to see how they're going to do it because they can't have an audience. So they're doing it kind of like they did the political conventions. And it would be easy for them to say, well, when this thing is over, we'll have this. But applause for the innovation. I'm like, well, people figured out a way to say, no, the show must go on. There's something about that, and I miss the energy of an audience, but there's something about that that feels very attractive. No, I'm not reflecting anybody that didn't show up today, but clearly people are very comfortable with just, they like my message, but if they can watch it in their pajamas, I'm not mad at you. I'm just saying, you know, there's more of y'all there than there are right here in this park. So clearly, the message is, I mean, I love that you showed up today, and I'm going to be here all of September, and then we'll cross October when we get there. But the point is, my message transcends. It's not, well, when we get back in that theater, we'll start Metron. No, Metron was born out of the I am, so it exists in the I am. There will always, somebody asked me recently, when are you going to retire? I said, that's kind of irrelevant to me because, I mean, it's not for Ken, because Ken, you know, when he will talk about having time and being paid for time and a half and time off. And I have such a different work experience. So for him, I understand why you would want to do that. For me, I'm like, I kind of already live outside of time anyway. I mean, we could have spent the night in Chattanooga last night, and I could have just sent y'all out an email blast saying, we stayed up here, I'm just going to stream today. I mean, that's very, I think, I didn't foresee COVID coming, but on some level, I think I was preparing us for it because Metron will, I mean, there will always be a Metron, no matter what shape it shifts into. I saw that the first time I said, hey, let's go to the beach and meditate. I'll see you in 3 weeks on Jekyll Island. Bye. I walk out there on the beach, 60 people come walking up, you know, before dawn, really? And I just said, and they didn't plan this vacation. I just said, I'm going to go to Jekyll Island and meditate. See ya. There they are. I thought, wow, this is very next level. So I don't know where we're going after this. I'm saying when you stop judging everything through a I was or I will be and start seeing everything through an I am, it's going to change the way you feel about aging, the way you feel about time, the way you think about death, the way you think about religion. It's going to bring you a kind of peace that is going to feel very different to you if you've been living life on the clock. And we've all done that. You know, the whole reason, and I know I got to shut up, but the whole reason I did the art studio, I mean, I'd always kind of wanted one, but it wasn't like it was a major bucket list thing. But I remember on my, right before my 59th birthday, I thought, oh crap, I'm going to be 60 next year. And I kind of freaked out about it. I thought, I don't want to have a 60th birthday party. That's going to bum me out. Judah just turned 30, and I was telling him, I said, you know, on my 30th birthday, they brought in an actual casket, went to a funeral home and got a casket and had pallbearers bring it in, and they lift up the lid and it said, here lies Pastor Swilly's youth. Everybody thought it was amusing. I was not amused. I was looking around like, oh my God, I hate these people. And that was just 30. And so I remember thinking, I got to get proactive about 60, because just having a 60th birthday party is really going to bum me out. And that's where I got the idea. I thought, I'm going to start painting again. I'm going to have an art studio, and instead of a 60th birthday party, I'm going to have an art retrospective. And the whole thing, it kind of took on a life of its own, but it all came because of that, because I was living on the clock. And I got to get this stuff done by April 3rd, 2018. And I did, and it was awesome, one of the best nights of my life. And I sold enough artwork in one night to pay the whole rent of the studio for the entire year. So that was great. And I know that I can do it. Who knows? For my 70th, it might kick in again. I don't like birthday parties anymore. Like, I got to do something else. But in that length of time, since then, I already feel myself living less and less on the time, the was is. And I want to say it this way. Before, Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. I'm beginning to say now, before Jim Swilly was, I am. In other words, there was a date in 1958 when I manifested into this plane, but I was always here, and I will always be here. That's what I'm saying. I don't feel upset when people die, because I don't feel separated from them. I just feel like, well, they're just in another dimension. They're still here. And just open your heart. Maybe I'll put a comma here and talk more about this next week. But open your heart, and I'll do discussions just when I turn this off. We may or may not do a meditation. But thank you for streaming. If you didn't stream, then send me an offering. That's your penance for not showing up today. Make it a double portion. I didn't say it. I meant it, but I didn't say it. Anyway, I just speak an I am blessing on you, and we'll be here next Sunday in the park. For those of you that want to know how to contribute, I'll post all my links in a little bit. Peace. I love you. Stay in the I am.